sit down. Let's try to take your seats, please. Representative Zeller's got us running behind right away first thing in the morning, so it's a little nicer criticism than I had for him last night at the chamber dinner, probably, for those of you that were there. But thanks, everybody, for being here. Accountability for the taxpayers' money is a priority that we all share. Our next panel focuses on strategies for insisting on value. Peter Hegard will be drawing on his research and experience to talk about how to get a better bang for the taxpayer's dollar. Steve Rothschild draws on his experience in the private and nonprofit sectors to identify strategies for obtaining a return on investment. I invite each guest to make a brief presentation, starting with Peter, and then I will open the floor for questions and comments on the cards that you submit. Peter?
Thank you, Senator Bach, and good morning. I'm like Inez. I have no PowerPoint. I wouldn't know how to do one if my life depended on it. And I'm retired from the private sector, and I just find these issues of working on what makes Minnesota work better fascinating. And I find it was challenging in the private sector, no question about it, with great competition. These issues are even far more challenging because of the various constituencies you all have to deal with. So congratulations on your great public service. Hopefully what I have to say this morning will be helpful to your work. Copies of the book, More Bang for Your Buck, were distributed through the two mail offices at the Senate and the House. If you didn't receive a copy, just let me know after today's forum. My analysis and the recommendations in the final section of More Bang for the Buck are nonpartisan and simply offer some reform ideas that should make taxpayer dollars more cost-effective. What I suggest in the book is what I call advanced cost-benefit analysis, and by that I mean not just comparing one program or policy approach with another, but to do so in a manner that computes in dollar terms what a program's return on investment is to the state of Minnesota and, as importantly, to the individual taxpayer. Hopefully, this should help you prioritize as you look at various spending and investing options. I'll go through some examples of what a dollar invested by taxpayers returns to taxpayers over what might be a 3, 5, 10-year, or perhaps even longer period. To begin with, as background, I think we all agree that the best welfare program is a job, ideally paying a living wage. For the state to calculate the return on investment of a job skill training program it funds, we need to know several things. First, if the individual trained is still working in Minnesota, and if so, what is their annual income? Second, what was the individual's earning prior to training? And with this data, we can calculate the net gain in income and estimate quite accurately the benefit to the state from higher sales, payroll, income, and other taxes. Next, we need to know if the trainee had been on welfare, how much of this expense has been eliminated or reduced, and in addition, if they had been at risk of reentering the criminal justice system, we need to calculate the odds of that happening had they remained unemployed. These benefits, higher taxes, lower state expenses, can then be compared with the training and job placement costs to calculate the return on the taxpayer's investment. Now, currently, with the data available, we can come pretty close to making an accurate estimate of the return on investment of these state-funded programs. Accuracy can be enhanced greatly if there were better coordination with systems analyses between DEED, Human Services, and Corrections. With a modest investment, and I repeat modest, I believe this is doable as discussed in Section 3 of the book. Overall, it appears that the return on investment in our well-managed, and I stress well-managed, job skill training programs is an attractive range ranging between 10 and 20% annually after the 2 or 3 year years that it takes to achieve break even. That doesn't even consider the added benefits of stabilizing that family, providing better future prospects for the children involved, and giving Minnesota's employers an added skilled worker. Current demographic forecasts project a shortage of skilled and semi-skilled workers in Minnesota well over the next two decades. We also know that for a prospective worker to be even ready for job skill training, a number of other things have to be in place, such as stable housing, quality education from pre-K through high school, and where appropriate, advanced technical and higher ed training. Six workforce training programs are included in the study in the book, including Twin City Rise, founded by our next speaker, Steve Rothschild. Now I'd like to share with you some examples in the book of how return on investment metrics can be applied to programs that both help create jobs as well as prepare more Minnesotans for the world of work. A couple named Bill and Gail Roddy initiated a program at Hennepin County's Glen Lake Home School for delinquent young men called OSIRIS. By teaching basic computer skills to over 100 of these young men, they were able to reduce the recidivism rate at Glen Lake from 50% to 30% for one major group of 100 individuals. Then even further, they reduced it to 15% in a subgroup that in turn became teachers of computer skills in their own neighborhoods, some of our most challenged neighborhoods. It cost $70,000 for 9 months on average of incarceration at Glen Lake. The savings from the reduced recidivism rate were substantial, returning in a relatively short period of time more than $5 for every dollar invested by the taxpayer. Another example, Mike Tamale, who founded and manages an organization called the Neighborhood Development Center, teaches residents in lower income neighborhoods how to bring their off the back porch craft businesses to scale. With training and developing a business plan, ongoing technical advice, and modest financial support, the Neighborhood Development Center has created over 400 businesses over a 6 year period at a cost of $7.1 million. After 2 years, the initial cost of the program was recovered, and each additional year generates about $4.6 million in a whole range of taxes coming from the businesses, their suppliers, their workers, et cetera, averaging an annual return after that second year break even of 67% annually on the taxpayer dollars invested. In certain cases, we have to look at the benefits of a program over an even longer time frame. This is especially true in the areas of education and job skill training. Admission Possible is a program that mentors high school kids who never dreamed of going to college. Students are exposed for the first time to the benefits of higher education and then shown a timeline that illustrates how with good grades and access to college funding programs, they can achieve the impossible. The cost per student is $3,000. The benefit is lifetime earnings of at least $1 million higher than they would have had with just a high school diploma. The added taxes paid translates into a return of over $4 for every $1 invested over a 40-year period. $2.63 for each $1 invested simply over a 10-year period. Other examples of ROI analysis in the book that offer high returns include affordable housing programs, early childhood education, after-school boost-up programs, the benefit, and here's a major one that you're already working on, the benefits of delaying entrance into expensive nursing home care, mortgage foreclosure prevention, curing child abuse, neglect, and there are others. Now for just a moment, I'd like you to close your eyes and envision that we have developed in Minnesota cost-benefit or return on investment analysis systems to the point where we had no disagreement on the facts related to which programs offer the highest payoff to the taxpayer. The political debate might then be better able to be focused on what we can afford to spend overall as well as what general areas of spending are most needed by our state at this particular point in time. The state of Washington has made great progress in this respect. Their approach is outlined in the book. Additional examples of how leading national research think tanks apply cost-benefit analysis to state government issues are also included in Section 4 of the book. I believe we can do the same by enlisting Minnesota's leading accounting firms to assist current efforts now underway in our nonprofit and foundation communities in terms of developing better metrics on how we run our government. What I'm suggesting is not rocket science, but simply measuring more effectively the value of what we do, and then in turn being able to communicate to the taxpayer in a manner that helps them become more effective citizens and you, our elected officials, more effective leaders. Thanks for letting me share these thoughts with you.
Good morning. What I'm going to show you may overlap a little bit with what Peter just reviewed with you. And the reason for that is actually good news, I think. It just shows that those of us who have been studying this issue for many years think very much alike. There's not a lot of disagreement about what the issue is, how to assess the issue, what we ought to do about it, and how it can be helpful to you as policymakers. I'm also reminded of an article I once read that said that for adults to really get something, they have to hear it 6 times. So this will be 2 towards that goal. The other thing I would say is that you could see in the program that I also have a book. It's coming out next month called The Non-Nonprofit, For-Profit Thinking for Nonprofit Success. You know that you didn't get the book like Peter provided his. It's not because I'm cheap. It's just that I'm a registered lobbyist and they won't let me do it. But I can give you a hell of a good deal if you want to buy it. You, as policymakers, already know that, and you have a very daunting task. You have to be accountable to the taxpayers to spend their money wisely, and at the same time, do the public good. My point to you is that you are not using the tools that are available to do that well. And I'd like to spend some time talking about that, what the tools are, and how they could be used, and give you a couple of examples about how they already are being used in Minnesota, whether you realize it or not. So this deals with the same concept that Peter talked about, and many of these things overlap: cost-benefit analysis, return on investment, net present value. You've probably heard them all. It's not important that you be an expert. But fundamentally, what return on investment does from your perspective as a policymaker is puts you in the position of an investor, not a spender. And you're thinking about, how do I invest the public's money in a way that gives us the best return while meeting social goals? They're not independent of each other. They're linked. And if you take them apart, they have no real meaning. You have to keep that in mind. I've been asked, well, you know, this is kind of theoretical stuff. I mean, I'm interested in cash. That's how we set the budget up in this state. I'm talking about cash. We're not talking about future theoretical stuff. We're talking about what is the cash return that the state gets, and as Peter indicated, from higher income taxes, revenues on the one side, lower public spending in the form of entitlements, and direct costs for things like corrections, for example. But what is that cash return to you? And as we could see, cash is really a function of tax increases for you, lower subsidy payments, and direct expenses that you make. And all of this has to be measured and has to be captured and booked in state budgets. This can't be outside of the realm of the budgeting process. It has to be within the budgeting process, and the budgets that get the benefit have to be accountable for that benefit so you can keep track of it and account for it. That's absolutely critical to have veracity and integrity in this system. Now, some other people have said, you know, this return on investment is business talk, and, you know, it's fine if you're a farmer trying to buy a piece of equipment or somebody trying to make a personal investment, but where does it fit in the state? We're about serving people. This is about human services and social good. And I would suggest that it makes sense for the reasons that are cited there, and that is that quality providers, and most of them are nonprofits in this state that get contracts from you, various commissioners, quality providers create social value. I think most people would agree with that, right? Or we'd shut them down. Not all of them, but the quality ones do. I would suggest, and this is the important piece, that social value equates to economic value in most cases. When somebody goes back to work, not only do they get a personal benefit, does their family get a benefit, and the community get a benefit, but the state gets an economic benefit because they get more in income taxes, they get more in sales taxes, and you pay less in subsidies, less low-income health care, less low-income child care, and the like. And this has been measured, it's been captured, and it's tracked, and we can do it through Social Security numbers. And that economic value is the same as cash. And the nice thing about cash is it's not only nice to have, but it's a universal way to measure things. And that's really important. So you can compare across areas and within areas and make reasonable judgments about where the best returns come from for your social interests. So what are the benefits of this? I think the first one is really important. The data that you often get today only allows you to look at outputs. I've been in many a hearing where a legislator has turned to the committee administrator and said, well, you know, what is the outcome here? And so I'm sorry, we don't collect that. I can tell you how many people graduated from this program, how many people were placed in a job, how many people may even have the job after 180 days, because that's what our contract says. But I would ask you as policymakers, is that really what you're spending the money for? You want a long-term impact. You want an outcome, and I would suggest an outcome in that case is, did they keep the job for a long period of time, and did their income go up? You can measure that with return on investment. You can't with the tools that are now primarily used by legislature and government to make strategic decisions, often with misleading results. The other thing is that this is a values analysis. This is not about costs. When you buy a car from General Motors, you don't really care how much it costs them to make the car. You care about what it's worth to you. And I would submit, when you make an investment in a social program, you should care about what the value is to the state, not what it costs that program to operate. That's their concern, to stay in business, but it shouldn't be your concern. And in fact, recent research done by the Wilder Foundation of 22 workforce programs showed that the ones that were the high-cost programs had the highest return on investment. And yet we put a lot of money into the low-cost programs because we look at cost, not value. Third, you are captured by the two-year budget cycle, right? And I was talking to somebody in the Department of Human Services not long ago who said, you know, I have some wonderful ideas here, but they don't pay out for 4 years, so we never bring them forward. That's kind of foolish. We ought to be doing things like that. This analysis allows us to think like that and get the benefits of that and avoid the kind of short-term tactical spending that doesn't lead very far and leads to outputs at most. And then finally, if you do this really well, you can take it to the next level, and that is drive accountability through the whole system by holding your providers accountable, by paying them for the results that they develop. Instead of getting a grant, you get all or part of the money based on the value you create for the taxpayer in providing that social service. Now, this is not a panacea. There are risks in this. One of them is that the key question here is not measuring stuff. You basically use the same formula, whether it's you're dealing with aging issues or child care or early education or workforce development. It's all about revenues and expenses, taxes and savings. The key question is, what is the social benefit of the public policy. For example, in workforce, as I suggested, it's not whether they graduated or whether they got a job, it's whether they kept the job and their income went up. That's what we ought to be measuring. And that's the most important thing that policymakers have to think through. What is the purpose of their social spending? You got to make sure that the data is accurate, of course. Garbage in is garbage out, if it's not. And then there are exceptions. This is not going to work in every area. It doesn't work in the arts. It won't work with a zoo. It doesn't work where there's no direct link between social benefit and economic value. And in those cases, we ought to invest in things for their intrinsic value and leave it at that. Twin Cities Rise is an example of an organization that's had a pay-for-performance return on investment contract with the state since 1997. And I'll skip to the bottom and show that the state's ROI over this period of time is over 600%. Now, that's cumulative, not annual. The state has earned $34 million and invested $4.6 million using the kind of formula that Peter suggested. And this formula was developed by the old planning department, Tom Gillespie and Barbara Ronigan, who some of you may know. So this can be done, and it is being done. And then more recently, a new statute was passed last year to apply this in a wide variety of areas in the state, including workforce development, drug treatment, supportive housing, employment of the disabled. It could also be used in higher ed and healthcare. And these economic studies have already been done by the Wilder Foundation. So the implications are that this is a way to become more objective in how you make decisions, be more strategic and more transparent. It drives changes throughout the entire system. Nonprofits will have to respond and start thinking differently, acting differently, and getting better results as a result of this. That should improve taxpayer confidence in what we spend our money on and how we do it, and it would enable us to do pay-for-performance contracting where it's appropriate. Thank you very much.
Who is collecting the questions? And I think in order to get on track, we probably only have time for two. So I'll pick them. Two out of nine. Well, I don't have much of a selection. Okay, here's one for Deed. A year or two ago, we put in place a return on investment review process for Department of Economic Development funding recipients. How do we know that the return on invested formula and the process is a good one so we can trust the results?
Well, you want to go ahead? I just say that I'm aware that the Deed, the Governor's Workforce Council, the United Way, Invest in Outcomes and Wilder Economist have been meeting for the last 3 or 4 months to bring all the formulas together. So there'll be one formula. Now that's being overseen by a number of economists, people in the state and people at the university and at McAllister College. So what we're getting is a consensus on exactly what that formula should be.
Let me just add that an initial simplistic approach, until we get this refined down more precisely, an initial simplistic approach would be for the legislature indeed simply to say, hey, we're going to create an artificial pool of $10 million, and we're going to set that up with a timeline of, let's say, three bienniums. And out of that pool of $10 million, we're going to take, let's say, the top 10 workforce training programs. We're going to pull out of that pool the cost of training those individuals that are placed and still in the job 2 years after training. And we're going to have between Deed Human Services and Corrections, this thing I was talking about earlier, we're going to put back into that pool the savings in corrections and human service expense, et cetera. And let's measure it. Let's draw the line after three bienniums and see where we are. That would be a simplistic approach that would almost cost the taxpayer nothing.
How do you measure the value of a program compared to a control group?
In point of fact, that Pay for Performance Act, there is an evaluation that does exactly that. So what you would do is you would take each individual that's in the group that is being treated, and you'd follow them through their Social Security numbers to see exactly what happens to their increase in taxes, if there are any. That would happen in a workforce program, presumably, but not happen necessarily in an area where person's in going into a different kind of community service for the aging. But then you'd also look at the change in cash to the state as a result of subsidy savings. And you compare that to a matched group of people who look alike in many ways, demographically and other ways, and you look at the differences. And so the return is based on the differences between a matched payer. That's the kind of controlled group. And that's the way you ensure that you have integrity in this process. So it avoids the argument, well, this would have happened anyway, right? How do you know that that was the reason, that the treatment actually led to the change that occurred? This would compare it to a control group. It's the Cadillac way to do it. It's expensive, but that's what we're planning to do in a wide variety of areas.
We're going to do one more. Here's a very good question. I don't know who sent it up, but outcomes require data. How can we measure outcomes in social services, especially healthcare, in the face of concerns that government doesn't own the data?
Well, I would say healthcare is the next great step forward. It's very difficult to try to make a stab today, and that probably ought to be a separate focus area. It's easy, relatively easy, to do it in workforce development programs, somewhat easy to do it in housing programs, somewhat easy to do it in corrections programs. I'd say healthcare is the big one. I don't have an answer, but I would say the same group that Steve's talking about, the work that's been done through both the community foundations, the United Way, Wilder, that would be the next big challenge.
Yeah, we've looked at that. And as I said, the key issue is what is the social outcome that's worth measuring, right? So think about healthcare for a moment. Right now, we pay for the amount of services providers get, right? They get paid fee for service. What if you were to change that and said the real value is the ability of a provider to help somebody get well or to keep them well, and to measure that and reward organizations for that? I'm not suggesting that's easy, but it changes the nature of what you reward based on the social benefit that individuals and the state receive. And there's some thinking going along this line. I think Southdale, the Fairview system is doing some experimenting in this area. So there's work being done. I'm not familiar with all of it. But once you can define what the social outcome is that you think is worthwhile, you can start measuring it.
And maybe, you know, maybe the place to start would be looking at those successful programs that delay someone an immediate risk of going into a nursing home, those programs that delay that. The one that comes to mind is one done by an outfit in St. Paul that I think the cost is $7,000 to train someone with their meds as well as the use of these various devices you need when you become relatively immobile. The payoff by delaying entrance into a nursing home that roughly would cost, what, $50,000 a year, you recover your costs in 2 months. And I would say if we're going to expand that to broader healthcare, that might be a logical place to start, because certainly the outcome is how many months can you delay entrance into expensive nursing care? There may be an analogy there for how long can you defer entrance into the emergency room or intensive care or whatever. I think that's where I'd start, Tom.
And Peter and I are particularly concerned about being delaying our entrance into a nursing home, I can assure you.
Well, I think most of us out there, our legislators, are thinking the legislature is a different animal. And it's not like trying to measure outcomes and return on investment in a business where you have a lot of long-term continuity and institutional memories. There are going to be 60 new freshmen next November. And just what they'll be, you know, about the right number. And they're going to come very excited with their own perceptions, and it's very hard to build continuity when you have this revolving door at the legislature. So it's especially a challenge. If you have thoughts that you could share with us privately as to how we deal with the fact that it is a different kind of workplace with people moving out so frequently, it's very hard, almost impossible, to bind the next legislature on something. But thank you both very much. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
We are going to take, in order, to get close to half on track, we're going to release you to the playground, but there are no monitors out there, so please play nice, and let's try to get back in 5 to 7 minutes so that we can resume and try to get back on track. Thank you.